Welcome to Nightcap with Jim. I'm the titular Jim, and tonight we shall be beginning our three-part series on my picks for the three most influential American directors, beginning with Steven Spielberg. For more content you may enjoy, please check out our Morning Mugami podcast and our other social media content at Mugami Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Let's get into it. Alrighty, so to start off this week, talking about my picks for the top three most influential American filmmakers, I decided to start off with Spielberg, Steven Spielberg. Strap in, this is going to be a big one. He's done a lot of stuff, so we got quite a few topics to discuss. I thought I'd just basically kind of do, generally just go over, his entire directorial filmography, just so you know what he's done, and then I'm going to break it down, there's some things that I'm just going to kind of gloss over and, not talk about, get in depth too much. I just want you to know about these projects because of how extensive, how long his filmography is, directorially speaking. Some of these projects I'm going to go into depth and talk about them for a little bit. So let's start off with the start of his career, and he started out actually doing a couple of TV shows, namely Marcus Welby, M.D., Name of the Game, The Psychiatrist, Columbo, Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law, and Night Gallery. He followed these up with a couple of TV movies, Duel being his directorial debut, his film debut as a director, and Something Evil as well. He then moved on to Sugarland Express, and a couple other things. Then we come to what I call the beginning of epic, and this is when his career really started to take off. And we start with Jaws. Now I love Jaws so much. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's one of the most impressive feats, I think, of any film, and it is the original summer blockbuster. It spawned the blockbuster genre, if you will, of just big tentpole movies. So we have Spielberg to blame for where we are now. But Jaws is just so impressive in so many different ways. I mean, great performances, really good cast. Even though Richard Dreyfuss and one of his co-stars didn't get along very well, it still works out. And then on top of that, you have these amazing special effects. I mean, I still, even after seeing documentaries on Jaws, I still have no idea how they got the shark animatronic to work the way it did in the water like that. I have no idea. It's just one of those things where it's just like, how in the hell did they do that? It defies just everything. I mean, I just have no, it freaks me out because I just can't figure it out, because usually I'm pretty good at least having an idea of how, this could work. And I have, one or two ideas, but they're just not quite feasible, Spielberg asserting, his mastery of technical, of just insane technical feats, just absolutely incredible work. I mean, if you don't love Jaws, I think you're just not living life right. And I love the way that the film is structured as well, where you have this great build-up, over the course of the first half of the film, and then you get, So you get through Act One and Act Two, and then Act Three is the second half of the film. That's what I consider it to be anyway. And that's when, you know, you have the three guys out there on the boat hunting for the shark. And, you know, it's just so fantastic because you go from having this, you know, these, you know, scenes with all these extras and, you know, large scenes with, you know, many, many cast members. So it's very ensemble-like in certain scenes. And then to transition into just three dudes on a boat, you know, just dealing with the problems of, you know, maintenance of the boat, you know, because it's kind of an old rickety kind of a boat, you know, so stuff, you know, going wrong here and there, and then, you know, trying to find the shark, and then, you know, just all this great stuff. And it's just so much fun too, you know. But it's also very interesting because there's a couple, like when the first when they start the chase sequence, this music comes in that's, you know, very, very different. I mean, we all know the classic theme, you know, the ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na-ba-na Jaws, and you know they're trying to you know shoot these barrels into him so that he can't descend into the depths of the ocean. You know, there's this, you know, very light, airy music comes in that's, you know, if it was any other composer, you know, and they were like, I kind of want to go this way with the music in this scene, it would just not work. In this particular case, it actually does. I mean, normally this kind of music would seem way out of place in this scene and in this movie, especially with the music and the experiences that we've had with the shark up until this point, which have been very horrific and traumatic. But to have this, you know, very airy, adventure-y music come in is a very bold choice that I think works very well. Side note, Jaws possibly has some inspiration from a real-life event where a shark was hunting and killed several people way, way back when, and I believe like around, you know, 1913, 14, 15, off the coast of, I think, New England. So that's interesting, you know, kind of, you know, just a little bit, you know, little throw in, a little, you know, little wink to, you know, some real life events, which is interesting. Moving on after that, we come to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now, this movie, you know, probably not a lot of audiences, you know, audience members in my generation know about this movie too much, unless, you know, you're a film fanatic like I am, or, you know, you like science fiction. It's one of these movies that is definitely a classic, and I highly recommend you check it out. I can't go into it too deep because I have a lot of stuff to get through in this episode. So I will just say this, check out Close Encounters. It's a really dope movie. Richard Dreyfuss returns to work with Spielberg again, and they make a really good team, so they end up making a really great film. All right, gonna take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about the meh of Spielberg's career. Stay tuned. All right, so the meh. Now, this is a pretty short list because, you know, Spielberg, he makes quality movies. Let's not, you know, make any mistake or have any sort of, you know, misgivings about his talent. He's very talented and he makes really imaginative and amazing movies, but, you know, there's a couple of duds. So 1941, I wouldn't say it's a dud necessarily, but it's definitely not kind of up to, you know, the usual world-class Spielberg standees. It's a good movie. I've got to say, I always thought that it was pretty good, but, you know, it's just not quite there, you know, for whatever reason, but, you know, stuff happens sometimes. And then obviously the elephant in the room, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Crystal Skull. Kind of like a what? You know, I don't know. You know, just something happened with it, and yeah, you know. What are you gonna do? which kind of sucks because, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in it. You know, like the action is great, as per usual in a Spielberg film and in an Indiana Jones film. I mean, Harrison Ford, impressive as always. I mean, the dude is like 1,000 years old, but he still does his own stunts whenever he can, you know? I mean, that's impressive. You know, you gotta love Harrison Ford. He's just fantastic. but him in real life is absolutely, like, the best thing ever. He kind of revels in, you know, just like kind of making things kind of awkward or whatever, just like, you know, he's and, you know, it's just awesome. If you ever get the chance to just like go on YouTube or whatever, just go on the internet and like look up like interviews with him, you know, or, you know, like he was on the Nerdist podcast, you know, stuff like that, and he's just a riot. You know, I mean, like, if you're a fan of The Office, you definitely get a kick out of his, you know, the way he is in real life, especially in interviews. It's just fantastic. All right, so that's going to do it for the meh. I'm going to come back, and just to keep kind of a, you know, a theme, kind of, well, not a theme, but, you know, to keep it, or, I don't know. No. Never mind. So that's it for the meh, and now we're going to continue on with our chronological ascent through his career, so I'll be right back. Alright, if you're listening to this on Anchor, you obviously know what I'm going to talk about next, and that is Indiana Jones. Now, I know this isn't necessarily in chronological order, but let's keep it all together. So we're just going to do the Indiana Jones trilogy, and because, well, we don't acknowledge the film that shall not be named, even though I named it in the last segment. So we start with Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, and wow, you know, like, I mean, in the Indiana Jones trilogy is just one of the most extraordinary pieces of filmmaking, I think that there's ever going to be, you know. They're just incredible films. And starting with Raiders, you know, it's such a bold movie, you know, such a very ambitious start to the franchise, and that definitely continues on through the rest of the films. But you know, it's always if that first one doesn't hit, you know what I mean. So you know, just absolutely, just Spielberg in his element, you know, just really, really just going for it, you know, swinging for the fences and connecting and hitting that just home run, you know, that walk-off homer that wins the game, just killing it. I mean, the stunts are insane, you know, they're just absolutely extraordinary, you know, all the technical aspects of his films, Spielberg's films, are just top-notch. You know, there's very few directors that are able to get that technical level of mastery that Spielberg has. You know, you got your Christopher Nolan, you got your Martin Scorsese, you got your Peter Jackson, you know, a couple others, but, you know, not a lot can really get to that level of just, like, blowing your mind out of your butt. Because you're just like, what the machine? It's just incredible, you know. And a little side note, there was a fan film about 25, 30 years in the making that these kids started making when they were, you know, very young. And, you know, starting when they were 12 or 10 or 12. And, you know, for the next 6 to 8 years... while they were coming up through high school, that's what they did every summer, was making a shot for shot remake of Raiders. And then, you know, the project got put on hold for a long time because they've got everything except for that iconic fight underneath the plane on the airfield. And so, you know, all these years go by and these guys get back together and they get the band back together, and they got the opportunity. They got some investors to fund the, you know, them getting able to finish this thing off. One thing that's interesting, though, because there is a documentary about this that's very amazing that you should check out, Raiders, you know, the making of the greatest fan film of all time. When they were going to do the explosion, the big, you know, kaboom of the plane, you know, they have a safety meeting, obviously, with the pyrotechnics guy, you know, describing, you know, how this is going to go, how this is going to work out. And he doesn't follow his own rules because something, you know, happened wrong, you know, and the explosion didn't go off. It didn't fire. And this guy walks into the danger zone after, you know, this safety briefing where he's like, we're going to do a half an hour of cool down. And that's it. And but then this guy walks in and he gets blown up, you know, and it's just like, come on, pyrotechnics guy, like, you didn't listen to your own stuff. You know, nothing against the dude, but it's just like, you said not to go in there. Why are you going in there? I mean, it's just bad timing, you know, because, like, you know, I think when you're dealing with pyrotechnics, explosives and whatnot, in the film industry, you do have to take so many steps, and I'm just, you know, I'm one of these people that, you know, yeah, I want to do these big, crazy movies with amazing stunts like that, but safety has got to be your number one concern at every juncture. You know, there's just, I mean, unless you're Tom Cruise. I'm just kidding. Tom Cruise is actually very safe, but, you know, it's just like, come on. You know, and then we move on to, Temple of Doom in 84, which is just a really great, you know, sequel to a really great follow-up to Raiders that, you know, comes back into that, you know, that mythical, you know, that magic and the supernatural elements of things, which is just fantastic. And then, you know, we move into The Last Crusade in 89, and this is actually my favorite of the trilogy. I just love it so much. You know, Sean Connery as Indy's dad is amazing. River Phoenix does a great job as young Indy in this great opening sequence. That's fantastic. Just so much fun, this movie. You know, John Rhys Davies coming back from Raiders, and that's awesome. You know, and then just these amazing, just mind-blowingly awesome action sequences that are just, you know, pushing the envelope as far as they can. As a side note, something else that you might want to check out is The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. It's a television series, and it's very, very excellent. One episode in particular that stands out in my mind is an episode that takes place during World War I that's just amazing. So if you're an Indiana Jones fan, you're definitely going to want to check out Adventures of Young Indiana Jones as well. I apologize again. You know, I would like to go into a little bit greater detail, but we have a lot of stuff to get through in this episode. We're just about halfway through. It's a lot of stuff, guys. So it's a big one. I mean, Spielberg, he's got over 61 credits to his name just as a director. You know, that's not including his production, you know, credits at all. So we got a lot of stuff to get through. So I'm going to take a little break and we'll be right back, and we're going to be jumping through from 85 to 91. So we're going to be talking about Color Purple, E.T., Twilight Zone, Empire of the Sky, and Hook coming up. So stay tuned. It's going to be good. All right, so now we come to 1985 and the color purple. I'm going with this one before E.T. and the Twilight Zone film, just because I don't know why. but anyway, so this movie is interesting for a number of reasons, but you know, it is what it is. You know, some great debuts, acting wise, from Whoopi Goldberg. You know, Oprah Winfrey's in it. You know, all these amazing people. But what's kind of interesting, one of the things that interests me the most is the story of how Spielberg came to direct it. And so Quincy Jones, he offered it to Spielberg, and Spielberg wanted to pass on it, citing that a person of color should probably direct it because they would have, you know, more of a connection to the material and, you know, just be able to tell it better than he probably could. And Quincy Jones hit him back with, well, did you have to be an you didn't have to be an alien to make E.T., so you can do this. So that's just one of, you know, just a little thing like that that's kind of, you know, is pretty interesting to me. You know, I just like little stories like that of, you know, like, how did this guy get to make this movie, you know, and stuff like that. But yeah, so anyway, now we're moving on to, we come to E.T. in 82. I mean, E.T., what can you say about E.T. that hasn't been said, you know, 1,000 times? I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, it's fantastic. This story of this alien, you know, coming and, you know, befriending these children and this family, and then just all this just intense sort of fear and hate mongering from, you know, these government officials that are just, you know, terrified that there's an extraterrestrial being on Earth, and they have no idea what to do, and they don't understand, and it's, you know, equal parts, you know, amazing and terrifying, you know, from the perspective of an audience member, in my opinion, especially, you know, when you see it when you're younger, you know, because it's one of these movies where, you know, it's like anime and manga does so often, putting children in these situations where they have to, you know, face danger far earlier than they ever should, you know, they rightfully should. And that to me kind of is just like the almost like the pinnacle of high drama, is when you put children in these kinds of situations where they have to step up and be the hero, which is really freaky, you know. But you know, Spielberg again killing it, you know, again technical mastery. You know, I mean, the E.T. animatronic and the puppet and whatnot is fantastic. Very interesting choice, though, I would say, for the look of E.T. But they definitely make him look as non-threatening as possible, which is another, I think that's just, you know, another way for us to connect with him and not be terrified, like, you know, and for us not to react to his presence like these government, you know, officials and stuff. And then he did the Twilight Zone movie in 83. Now, if you don't know what the Twilight Zone is, you need to just get your head out of your ass. Pardon my French, but you do. Twilight Zone is incredible, you know. I'll drop one for you right now, just the very first episode. You know, this episode where it's the last man on Earth, and it's just these extraordinary self-contained tales that have these incredible Hitchcockian, you know, good M. Night Shyamalan movie twists to them, you know. and you're just like, your mind just gets blown over and over and over again. It's amazing. So you gotta get into the Twilight Zone, guys. You gotta. You just gotta. And then we come to Empire of the Sun in 1987. Now, this movie is so amazing. It's so incredible for so many reasons. You know, it's an incredible story, told in an exceptional way, with Christian Bale putting in one of the finest performances of his career, for sure. And he did it when he was a kid, you know. And he just absolutely destroys in this movie. He's so good. When you see how Christian Bale is an amazing actor throughout his entire career, and with his career starting when he was a kid, you know, and the fact that he's not this one of these, you know, like he didn't do a Robert Downey Jr. or a Macaulay Culkin or any of that, you know, and he, like, he just, none of the nonsense that can happen when you attain fame, you know, he didn't do any of that Bieber crap or any of that stuff, you know. Just, he's kept it together, you know, and that's just amazing, you know, and it shows you what a consummate professional this guy is, with the exception of the one time he ruined, like, the biggest shot of the movie, which was, it's if you ever watched the trailer for Empire of the Sun, it's in the trailer. And it's Jim, his character Jim, Christian Bale's character Jim, and he's on top of this building. And if you don't know the story, it's this kid, and they're living, and it's his and his family are living in Shanghai, right at the onset of World War II and the, you know, and Japanese invasion, and so he ends up in a POW camp, and so it's pretty intense. This one particular day, you know, American fighter planes rock over the camp and they start blowing crap up. Jim, he's supposed to be on top of this building and cheering them on. So jumping up and down and waving his arms and yelling, yeah, yeah. And Christian just kind of biffed it. and they used up all the explosions. So Spielberg had to have, you know, a little fatherly chat with him and be like, come on, man, you're killing me here. Let's do this. And made it work out. So that's good. You know, again, Spielberg just showing you why he, why he's just one of these kings of cinema. Absolutely fantastic. And now we come to 1991. Actually, before I move on, let me actually say this. I'm going to save that for later. So now we come to 1991, and we come to Hook with Robin Williams. Now this, some of you guys might, you know, if you know the movie, you might be wondering why I didn't put this in the mess segment, because it's not one of his more well-known films, and some people, you know, aren't too, you know, aren't huge fans of it, but I am. I think Hook is a really good movie. It's definitely, you know, something different. Because we're dealing with Peter Pan as a grown-up, which is something that Peter Pan said he would never do. He said he would never grow up, but he does, and now, and you get this amazing performance from Robin Williams, you know, and he was just the perfect actor to cast as Peter Pan, as a grown-up, you know, this guy that, you know, has kind of lost all of his childness, his childlikeness, and rediscovers that, and it's just a truly beautiful performance, you know, I think, and, you know, Dustin Hoffman as Captain Hook, you know, I mean, come on, it's Dustin Hoffman, it's DH, the guy's a fantastic actor. But yeah, one guy's opinion, Hook's awesome. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with the 90s. This is where it's going to get a little controversial. I'm going to say some stuff that some of you guys might not like, and I don't care. So we'll be right back in a few minutes.
Hey, Nightcap listeners, this is Heath from Mungami, and I'm also the host of Mungami's morning show, Morning Mungami. You should go and check it out. Start your day off right, Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. And, you know, I have Sunday specials. Does Jim have any Sunday specials? No. And, I wasn't going to say it, but I'm also better looking.
All right, now we're diving into the 90s, and this is where Spielberg made some of his, you know, most incredible films, some of his most iconic films, probably what he's best known for, especially to my generation, having been born in the 90s, you know, I've noticed that, you know, a lot of people my age don't really dive too far back, which is kind of a bummer, but, you know, to each his own. You know, you like what you like, and it doesn't matter when you like, when that stuff it came out, you know. So, you know, it's whatever. So we start off in 1993 with Jurassic Park. Now, Jurassic Park. What, again, you know, it's one of these things, what can you say about Jurassic Park that hasn't already been said 1,000 times over, you know, just fantastic filmmaking. It's just great, you know. Sam Neill as Dr. Grant, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, you know, Sir Attenborough, just fantastic, you know, Sam Jackson, Wayne Knight, just this amazing cast that just does a fantastic job dealing with this extensive special effects, you know, stuff that, you know, working with these giant animatronic dinosaurs and you know, using CGI. So, you know, you have to be standing in a field and pretending that you're looking up at a brontosaurus and that's got a 30-foot neck reaching up into a tree to get a leaf to eat, and you're just like, you know, I mean, and the music, I mean, ugh. John Williams is just one of the greatest composers of all time, for sure, you know. I mean, I could just break off the Spielberg thing and just talk about John Williams for an hour, because he's amazing. But no, we're just sticking with Spielberg. I did mention this in my last series when I went to see Jurassic World. Jurassic Park and The Lost World, these two movies scared the crap out of me when I was a kid because of the velociraptors. Now, it is something to note that the Jurassic Park franchise, the trilogy and the Jurassic World movies, don't necessarily portray dinosaurs in a 100% realistic fashion. Like, for instance, velociraptors didn't really look that way, you know, T-Rex didn't sound like that, and, you know, just all this other stuff, like a brachiosaur is not a real thing, it's just a brontosaur, you know, just stuff like that. So, or brontosaurus, the made-up one, brachiosaurus, I forget. But, you know, just, there's stuff. you know, for being, you know, for taking a lot of artistic license with these, you know, real creatures, which is fair because, I mean, you know, let's be honest, we've never seen one, you know, alive. Millions of years ago that, you know, that these things, these animals lived. And so, you know, and this is, you know, the early 90s too. Like, Jurassic Park is one of these movies that, you know, discusses a subject that not a lot of people have discussed, you know, whether it be within the scientific community or, you know, in film or, you know, whatever. I mean, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, that movie did the exact same thing that Jurassic Park did, or Jurassic Park, I should say, did the same thing that Butch Cassidy did, because when Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid came out, they you know, didn't have the full story, so they made a lot of guesses, and a couple of them guesses turned out to be true in Jurassic Park. And the reason that we found out that these things were true from Butch Cassidy is because the movie was so popular and people loved it so much that it renewed interest in these two guys' story. And Jurassic Park did the exact same thing. You know, Michael Crichton, the novel, and Steven Spielberg, the movie, and just had this. You have just have this incredible resurgence of interest throughout, you know, the artistic and the scientific communities to really, you know, just let's go at it hard and find out all we can about these, you know, magnificent creatures. So, you know, some pretty intense stuff. Now, I don't want to get too much into the behind-the-scenes stuff of Jurassic Park other than to give you, like, a little fun fact. If any of you guys are fans of Tool, the band, Adam Jones, the guitarist, actually worked on Jurassic Park working for Stan Winston and company doing models of the dinosaurs and stuff. So that's just a little fun fact for you. Now, Schindler's List is interesting because Schindler's List was actually filmed before Jurassic Park. And so while he's... I got that backwards. Jurassic Park was filmed first. And so this was a deal that Spielberg made in order to get Schindler's List made, was that they wanted him to do this, you know, a tentpole blockbuster film, and so they wanted him to do Jurassic Park in exchange for them letting him do Schindler. So he shoots Jurassic Park, but like I said, there's a lot of technical stuff going on, and including a lot of CGI. So that means that he's in post production on Jurassic while he's filming Schindler's List, and he's so bummed out making Schindler that, you know, he's just like, you know, he's kind of like, I just want to throw in the towel on doing these effects shots because I just don't care right now. And, you know, and it's just one of these things where you find yourself artistically in this weird place where, you know, you've got to do a job, and you can either give up and quit, or you can push through and get the job done. And Spielberg just, he amazes me in that he's able to multitask so efficiently and well, especially in this particular context, because this is one of the first times that he, you know, had two movies. This was like the first time that he had two movies coming out in the same year that are these huge, you know, kind of soul-sucking and time-consuming projects that just take, you know, just sap all the energy right out of you. And he's just incredible for being able to, you know, make a movie about dinosaurs and then make a movie about the Holocaust while he's still in post-production on a movie about dinosaurs. You know, I mean, that's just incredible. You know, an incredible work ethic. Just blows me away. And then we come to Amistad and Jurassic Park: The Lost World, both in 97. So again, two movies, same year coming out. Amistad is interesting. It's about a Spanish ship, a colony ship, that is carrying some Mendi people. And there's this whole controversy about whether or not they should be treated as slaves or as a free people. So that's, you know, some pretty heavy stuff to check out. And then, you know, again, he's contrasting that with another movie about dinosaurs. And The Lost World is actually my favorite of the Jurassic Park trilogy. And I might even say just of the entire Jurassic franchise. I really enjoy it. It's just a lot of fun for me, you know. But also I just love the idea of these dinosaurs, you know, just getting to spend more time with them, and then also like how they've evolved from how we see them in the first movie. In the first movie, you know, we see them as, you know, very as rogue elements, if you will. But with The Lost World, it's you know, animals in their rightful habitat, in the wild. And the T-Rexes especially fascinate me with this, the idea of familial bonds between, you know, Mr. T-Rex, Mrs. T-Rex, and T-Rex Jr. So I just really find that to be incredibly enjoyable. And then, you know, the Stegosaur scene is awesome. You know, it's just so cool. And this brings us to the controversy, Saving Private Ryan. All right, some of you are not going to want to hear this, and you're not going to like it, but I'm saying it. I hate Saving Private Ryan. I do not like it at all outside of the combat scenes. The reason why, all right, is because there is an actual true life story of four brothers during World War II who all joined up that is, for one thing, true, and secondly, way more interesting than Saving Private Ryan is. Now, to me, Saving Private Ryan is fantastic up until the end of the D-Day sequence, okay? Now, the reason I say this is because up until the end of D-Day, it is the best war movie of all time. Hands down, no contest. After that, it becomes an adventure action movie. And, you know, if you don't understand why I'm saying that, buckle up, okay? The reason I say that is because there was never an instance where a squad of dudes, you know, soldiers, 6 days after D-Day, walked halfway across France to save one guy, all right? It just didn't happen. I mean, it was tough enough for Patton and his guys, you know, trying to bust through Europe with, you know, tanks and companies of soldiers and stuff like that. And you're telling me that, you know, this little squad of eight is going to rock halfway across France? Like, no. Just, I call bullshit. You know what I'm saying? Especially because the true life story of these other four guys is just way more interesting. Two of them did die. And then, you know, one was a paratroop. So if you actually did the true life story, you would still have the D-Day sequence, which is amazing. You'd have, you know, him coming home because all of his brothers are dead, so you still get that emotional, you know, that deep emotion. And then it turns out that one of the brothers who was serving in the Pacific Theater, he actually wasn't dead, and he was taken prisoner by the Japanese. So now you've got a POW, you know, Great Escape Pacific Theater Edition movie, you know, where we have this guy in a prison camp, and he's, you know, trying to escape, and he does, and, you know, eventually makes his way home, and that's just way more interesting to me than, you know, an unrealistic plot of sending eight dudes on foot, you know, across France a couple of days after D-Day, when the German army still has, you know, a lot of assets still in country to combat the invasion. You know what I'm saying? I just find it completely unrealistic. Now, the combat, the way combat is depicted in Saving Private Ryan is definitely top-notch. I'm not going to dispute that at all. What I take issue with is just the plot. And now I can hear one or two of you guys who know about this deleted scene, all right, where after Miller and his squad have been given this mission, that they were given vehicles and that the vehicles were destroyed en route to the first town that they come to. I don't give a shit, okay, about deleted scenes, if you're talking about what happens in the actual movie, okay? And I'll tell you why. The movie is the movie. The deleted scenes are the deleted scenes. They're not the movie, okay? The movie is the movie. So what we see in the movie is these guys start off and just walk halfway across France. Okay. I really don't want to hear it. Okay. I apologize for getting a little combative and hostile about this point, but I really have to just make it clear that it just has no effect on me at all, that argument, if you try to make it, you know, because it's just what is in the movie. And what is in the movie is unrealistic, with the exception of how combat is depicted, which is top-notch, again. But anyway, I'll move on. I've finally said it on the podcast, so I don't have to talk about Saving Private Ryan ever again. All right, so I'm going to take a quick break, and now we're going to move into the aughts, the 2000s, and we're going to move up as far as we can to get to... I think we're going to stop the next segment at, we're probably going to get up to Tintin and War Horse, in the next segment. So stay tuned. It's still going, I know, but hang in there with me. It's going to keep, it gets better. It's going to get better and better and better. Alrighty, now we're finally into the 2000s, the aughts, and we start off with 2001's AI, Artificial Intelligence. This one's interesting because it's actually a movie that Kubrick wanted to do, Stanley Kubrick, and had been working on it for decades, just so long, and finally decided to hand it off to Spielberg, just because he felt that, you know, that would be more his speed. But there's, you know, still plenty of Kubrick left in there, which is great. I mean, Kubrick is just a master of cinema and just, you know, made some of the most incredible movies of all time, you know. Some stuff. And this kind of starts... the what's kind of called the Running Man trilogy that Spielberg started doing with and then moving into Catch Me If You Can. Catch Me If You Can is one of my favorite movies of all time. You know, DiCaprio and Hanks together just tearing it up. You know, such a great story. Frank Abagnale, this kid who runs away from home, becomes one of, you know, the world's most prolific forgers and con men, and all before he's 18 years old. You know, just such a fun story and a really fun movie. And then we come to another one of my favorite movies of all time. The Terminal. This one is another one that kind of flies a little bit under the radar, but is absolutely an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. You know, Tom Hanks is just one of these amazing actors, and when he gets together with Spielberg, he just annihilates. You know, he just gives these incredible performances. I mean, he does this accent in this film that is so perfect. It's hard to believe that it's not his regular speaking voice. You know, Hanks is one of these guys that, you know, he can really just nail these different accents and ways of speaking, in a way that not a lot of actors do. And, you can really tell about accent work, because it comes through the most when, you know, an actor is yelling, and and Hanks is just, he's just on point, and it's just fantastic. On the directing front, you know, you have this just amazing stuff going on. I mean, great camera work as per usual when you're talking about Spielberg, but also they actually built this terminal because, I mean, it was just unfeasible for them to shoot in an actual airport, for as long as they would have needed to. So they just built this amazing set and for them, you know, and it's just like this. I mean, if it was me, you know, in Spielberg's position, you know, making this movie, I would be like, it'd be, you know, a kid in a candy store just having this big old playground to play in. And you know, it just makes this, it just, this movie, it's just a really special movie to me, you know. I'll probably talk about it again sometime on the podcast and give it its own episode so I can really do a deep dive on it, because I just love it so much. I could talk about The Terminal forever, but we can't, because hey, it's been a pretty long episode so far, so let's just keep on driving through. And okay, so now we come to another double year, '05, with Munich and War of the Worlds. Now, Munich is definitely, you know, something different. I mean, with, you know, stuff like Schindler's List and Amistad and Saving Private Ryan, Munich falls into that category of, you know, just really intense stuff that, you know, just when you think about, you know, like Jaws and E.T. and stuff, and Indiana Jones, you don't really think that that's a Spielberg movie, but, you know, he's just got this, you know, I mean, we've, as, you know, I've been talking about for the past, you know, 39 hours, you know, he's just got this really diverse, filmography that's just all kinds of stuff, you know, comedy and drama, action and, you know, spectacle and science fiction, and just, it, he's just all over the place. And Munich is really one of these, you know, unique films that, you know, is telling a story that, you know, is not something that we all know about. That's not necessarily common knowledge, especially to Westerners, and Americans especially. I will say one thing that's kind of interesting. Well, actually, no, that's not really that interesting. Never mind. But, you know, obviously Spielberg does a great job on it. It's an amazing movie. It's breathtaking. I would definitely recommend it. It is super violent, though. So, you know, and very intense. So, you know, keep that in mind. And then we come to War of the Worlds. Now, it's interesting. Whenever he does one of these double years, it seems like every time he does a really super serious movie and then something that's a little bit lighter. War of the Worlds, this is one of the times, though, where both movies are pretty dark. War of the Worlds, you know, it's a remake of a classic, you know, science fiction film. And some people, you know, it's one of these divisive movies in terms of Spielberg's career that, you know, is like some people like it and some people don't. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what's the deal? So, you know, it's kind of a dealer's choice kind of thing. You know, it's like, eh. I think it's all right. You know, Tom Cruise does a pretty good job. Special effects are pretty, you know, as per usual, you know, there's a lot of money put into them, a lot of time, a lot of effort. So, you know, this and that. But, you know, it's, and, that's gonna wrap up the, 2000s. Now, some of you might be wondering, Jim, what about Minority Report? Well, got a special surprise for you coming up later in the episode on that. I think that's gonna be our closing segment, so, stay tuned for that, and, we'll be back to, jump into, War Horse, Tintin, Lincoln, Bridge of Spies, BFG, The Post, and Ready Player One. So stay tuned for that. We'll be back in a minute. All right. So we have a little treat for you guys. I've been on his podcast. Now he is on mine. Please welcome Heath LeBombard of Morning Manga Me. Welcome, Heath.
What's up, everybody?
Good to have you on, buddy. All right, so I omitted
Minority Report from the Yachts segment, because it turns out that this is actually Heath's favorite Steven Spielberg film. Interesting choice, Heath. Interesting choice.
Why do you say it's interesting?
Well, I mean, you know, you just look at his filmography, as we've been discussing over the past 59 hours on this particular episode of Nightcap with Jim. And it's just so iconic. You know, you have Jaws, you've got the Indiana Jones trilogy, the BFG, Bridge of Spies. I mean, just such, you know, War Horse, all these amazing movies. And I don't think a lot of people would think that Minority Report would be, you know, that kind of top level of somebody. So I was wondering what exactly it is about Minority Report that makes you, you know, love it more than, you know, all these other amazing and iconic films.
It's like it's like a short story almost, but it's 2 hours and like, it's like 2.5 hours. So it's actually not that short, but I feel like it's like a great story of like deception and like mystery. And I think it all being set in this like futuristic society just makes it feel like this like really tight and clean, story, like a standalone story. I know they did like a show about it, but like just like all just how the movie's presented, it just felt really like I said, tight, clean, and like it's just like a good like hero's journey with a bit of mystery in there. And I was just really entertaining. I know Spielberg has like a lot of classics and stuff, and there's some movies that he's made that I should like more than Minority Report, but Minority Report is just the, whenever I hear it, you know, I think Steven Spielberg, and
it's just the one that really hits you where you live.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you feel about the idea, the concept of the pre-crime police force? What do you think about that?
I mean, I love the idea. The only thing that gets me that, if it was applied in the real world, you would have problems of like, were they actually going to follow out with the crimes, you know? But at the same time, to have these three beings that can, predict the future is still, you know, there's probably a lot of other cool stuff going on in that universe as well. We just didn't get to see it because, you know, we were busy following Tom Cruise. So
yeah, this is very true. Now, for me, Minority Report, I think, is very good up until, like, it kind of loses me in the third act. I just, you know, I'm not too big a fan of it about that. But, you know, like, the opening stuff and, you know, these great action sequences and, you know, fights between Tom Cruise and Colin Farrell. How do you feel about how the movie came in and ended in the third act?
I don't remember if this is the third act, and I think it might be the second, but are you talking about when he gets like his new eyes and everything?
Well, I'm talking about after that whole, that tense sequence, which that's another thing that I do enjoy about this particular film is this sequence is very, that sequence is very tense. But I mean, after that, once they've, he's escaped the city and he's out, towards the end of the movie, how do you feel about the ending?
I mean, I like the ending. I, you know, off the top of my head, and I haven't seen the movie in a while, honestly, so I don't really remember everything about it, but I don't think there's anything that could be done to, like, really make the ending better. The only complaint I have with it is that it's just really predictable at that point.
Mm.
Like, when you get to the third act, like, it's just very predictable what's going to happen and who the actual bad guy is. It's like they kind of, they do a decent job of hiding it in the first two acts, and then they get to this third act and it's like, oh, okay, it's the guy that runs the whole operation, you know, his best friend. It's the guy on the inside with him, you know.
How do you feel about the idea that they kind of play with of predestination, that you cannot change your fate, that you're always going to end up where you end up no matter what? Because that is kind of a central theme in the film. Tom Cruise's character chasing after, you know, this man in the sunglasses and trying to prove his innocence, that he's not going to kill somebody, and yet he ends up exactly in that spot. How do you feel about this idea of predestination that the movie puts forth.
I mean, I'm a firm believer in that things happen for a reason. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my personal life, you know, that I believe that things happen for a reason. And I think for most people in the world, things happen to them for a reason. But the way that it's played within this movie would make me like a doubter of it, just because it's a you know, a prophecy machine that like tells you you're going to do this. And it's like, instead of arresting these people, why aren't we showing them what they're going to do? And then, you know, like bring them in and show them the vision and, you know, like help fix them that way. So like, it makes me question it. The movie makes me question it because of the context of like how, you know, their police force is made up. But in real life, you know, where I right now, I, you know, I believe things happen for a reason.
So, but okay. So, well, that's interesting because, because that's one of the things that I found interesting is that, you know, his character is, instead of doing what I think most, you know, people would do logically speaking, which is get as far away from, you know, like where this murder is supposed to take place, get as far away from there as you can. And if you're not there, then you can't be a murderer. But instead he does all this stuff to try to prove that he's not going to be a killer. But then it just comes back to that predestination thing, which I think is really interesting. A concept to play with in a film.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason why I love this film so much is because it plays with concepts that obviously I believe in my actual life. I think a lot of people do, and they take it and they make you question it just because of the state of, like, you know, technology, but really like kind of like magic in a way.
Yeah. Are there any other thoughts that you'd like to express about this film?
This is like one of the only films that I can watch where I don't see Tom Cruise as Tom Cruise. Mm. There's moments in the film where I see like, oh, that's Tom Cruise. But like, I have the hard time separating him, like Tom Cruise from the actual character he's playing in a film. And this is one of those movies that, you know, I actually don't see Tom Cruise through, especially like through the first two acts, I think, you know, because it's just, you're kind of enticed with what his story is and what's going on around him. Not saying that his other movies are not enticing, but like with War of the Worlds and stuff like that, like I just saw Tom Cruise.
Yeah,
it was just Tom Cruise going around fighting all the aliens that he, you know, he probably thinks are real because of Scientology. So
yeah.
Sorry, I had to.
No, I omitted that from my segment talking about which, you know, I because I remember when War of the Worlds came out and he was doing his press tour, you know, and he would just be, you know, I remember even sitting, I was on a trip and I was in the airport and he was, you know, doing his press tour and he was on a show getting an interview and they're trying to talk about War of the Worlds. And he's just like, well, no, but you have to delve into the history of Scientology and the this about Scientology. And it's like, dude, just spit out your one-liner about how aliens are cool or whatever, you know?
It's like, dude, I'm one of the biggest fans of Star Wars out there, but you don't see me going around like telling people they need to follow the Jedi code, you know what I mean?
Is there anything, any other Steven Spielberg stuff that you might want to discuss really quick?
I know you're doing directors, but he produced Super 8, and I thought that was a crappy film. And I think a lot of other people think it was a crappy film as well.
I mean, I thought it was all right. You know, it's definitely not like the greatest science fiction movie ever made.
It's boring.
But I mean, I thought it's just a different way to go. That's what I think about it, you know. But yeah.
But you also love every movie that you see, and it's the greatest one ever. So
no.
Yeah,
I think Super 8 is, it's just all right. And there's even a mess segment in this episode, Heath, that I do lay out that there are a couple of movies that Spielberg did that are kind of hit and miss, like especially the movie that shall not be named, Indiana Jones, number 4.
Oh, I was gonna say you don't like Indiana Jones, but yeah, Indiana 4. Actually, cool segment. or cool addition to Indiana Jones 4. I actually, one of my uncles was the stuntman for Indiana Jones during the scene where they were actually leaving Area 51, I think it is, and he whips the lamppost and he swings in and he lands on top of the hood of the car.
Mm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like big shot in the trailer too. That's actually my uncle, Carl Rice.
Oh, that's really cool. Hey, that's a great, that's a great little piece of trivia for our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Heath, thank you so much for coming on to my podcast for this segment. Thank you so much.
Well, I figured this, you know, you're tanking because it's not my podcast. So.
Okay, you're going to pay for that.
Hey, man, good luck with the rest of it.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Peace out.
All right, that son of a bitch, Heath, calling me out on my podcast. Like that. I'm going to get you, Heath. I'm going to get you. Ooh, you're going to get it. All right. That was a fun segment. Anyway. Damn it, Heath. Anyway, now we're into the 2010s, and we're going to kick it off with The Adventures of Tintin. Pretty interesting movie. Pretty fun. It's kind of one of these, you know, it's a good movie, but, you know, I mean, I might have to go back and watch it again because, you know, I mean, I was like, This is all right, but, you know, it's not really my jam. I mean, it may have just been, you know, a timing thing where I just wasn't in the right mode to watch it. But, you know, I guess I'll have to give it another listen and come back and maybe update you guys on my thoughts on it. But that'll bring us to War Horse. Now, I love this movie so much. It's just so incredible. You know, I mean, it really hits me at home, you know, because I don't think I've ever seen a movie like this where the animal is the main character, and, you know, all these people that are surrounding, that are around, they're more in the periphery, they're more, you know, supporting characters for the horse. And that's really a unique way to make a film, to really make the animal the star of the project. And it's just so, you know, tragic but also hopeful, and, you know, this wonderful horse just doesn't give up, just will not quit, you know, and he just keeps on going and going and going, and all these, you know, wonderful people from either side of the conflict who, you know, they just want to help the horse and to make sure that, you know, he's taken care of. And you know, it's just some really beautiful moments, juxtaposed against, you know, the horrors of war, you know, and during World War I, you know, especially, you know, some really intense trench warfare sequences, and you know, just really, really intense stuff. And that'll take us to Lincoln, 2012. I mean, what can you say about Lincoln? You know, Daniel Day-Lewis, he kills it. Really, really interesting take on Lincoln, you know. Like, one of the things I think that makes it so successful and made it so successful in theaters and, you know, has had its longevity is that it's a very compressed time frame, and it's, you know, it's just this particular section of time when he's trying to get this amendment pushed through, and I think that's brilliant to just focus on this one particular issue that he's going through, that he's trying to, you know, this one particular thing he's trying to do, because Lincoln's life is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened, so, you know, when you do something like, you know, for instance, you know, it's obviously fictionalized, but Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. That movie is, it's like all over the place because of just how much stuff is going on, you know, because you're going throughout all, you know, of a large portion of his life as opposed to just focusing on one thing. And Lincoln is one of these guys, you know, he's one of these people that just did so much stuff and had so much stuff happen to him that to put all of it, to try and put his whole life story into a movie is just kind of inconceivable and impossible in a way, because it would just be like a 20-hour movie. Which, you know, if it was Daniel Day-Lewis playing it, then I wouldn't complain. I mean, the guy can just flat-out act. You know, kind of sad that he's decided to, you know, hang up the film acting. I'm not sure if he's going to keep doing theater work, but he says that he's done with movies. But yeah, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt as one of Lincoln's kids, great job. James Spader, fantastic, you know. Just all these just amazing actors. Tommy Lee Jones, I mean, Walton Goggins, you know, just, ugh. You know, could gush over the cast of this movie for a long time. But let's keep it rolling, Jim. Let's keep it rolling, Jim. And that'll bring us to Bridge of Spies in 2015. This movie is, for those of you who don't know, it's about the a pilot, a United States pilot who flying a stealth plane is shot down, and Tom Hanks plays this lawyer who is tasked with securing his negotiating his release, and so he's got to deal with a prisoner from the Russian side that the Americans have, played to perfection by Mark Rylance. Now, I was going to say this earlier when I was talking about Empire of the Sun, but I decided to hold off on it until I got to here, because Mark Rylance passed on Empire of the Sun to do a theater project. So this working relationship that has blossomed now, with, you know, three movies that these two have done together now, Mark Rylance and Steven Spielberg, has been, you know, almost 30 years in the making. You know, from 1987 to 2015. So it's just this explosion of films these guys are doing. It's, you know, three out of the next four movies he's in, you know, or sorry, two out of the next three movies Mark Rylance is in. And, you know, these guys obviously have a really great working relationship together, because they just you know, they gel. And you really see that when you come to 2016's BFG, Big Friendly Giant, and he plays the BFG. So now he's got a starring role, you know, he's a lead in a Spielberg film, and he just does an amazing job with you know, having to deal with all the technical aspects of, you know, doing motion capture and whatnot. And you know, it's one of these things where it's a movie that couldn't be made without the advances in technology, that, you know, the strides that have been made, and it's just one of those things where it's like, it's got to be really tough to make a kind of movie like this, especially as an actor, when, you know, when you're a 10-year-old girl or whatever, and you're supposed to be acting opposite a giant, but there's nothing there for you. And, you know, and for the most part, there's not a lot of stuff for you to really interact with any either. And then, you know, the flip side of that is you have Mark Rylance, who's in, you know, the nylon outfit or whatever, with these little, you know, motion capture thingamabobby doodles all over, and having to act in a space that, you know, is nothing, you know, like what it looks like in the finished product. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, you had to work with an extraordinary talent when you're dealing with something like this. That'll take us to the post of 2017. I actually haven't seen this movie, so I'm not going to comment on it. We're just going to move right along to my favorite, one of my favorite, I mean, yeah, I would probably, maybe my favorite, Ready Player One. I remember seeing this movie in theaters, and then seeing it, and I just recently acquired it digital, and I just was blown away by it. You know, I mean, pop culture references up the wazoo. I mean, just the most, like, it's every pop culture reference. I mean, not literally everything, but like everything. You know, music, movies, TV shows, you know, fashion, anime and manga and comic books and video games. I mean, just every single type of media gets a reference of some kind, you know, books, movies, all of it, just every single thing you can, you know, and it makes for something really crazy, really trippy, but super awesome, you know. I mean, how can you not love seeing the Iron Giant in a squad of Master Chiefs, you know, and then you know, a dude in the DeLorean from Back to the Future rocking down a battlefield with stuff blowing up all over the place. I mean, how can you not love that? That's just awesome. But, you know, it's just such a fun movie, you know. Just it's just one of those kind of good time movies is what I like to call them, you know. There's not really too much, you know, deeper thinking you have to do. You can kind of turn your brain off if you want to. But the nice thing about Ready Player One, it's a good time movie that can make you think, you know, to think about virtual reality and immersive video games, you know, which is something that, you know, is possibly controversial, you know. I mean, especially if you look at some other projects, some other film and television that have utilized virtual reality, deep dive, immersion-based video games like Sword Art Online, which, you know, the first game, Sword Art Online, is a death game, you know, where these players are locked in it and prevented from being able to log out of the game, and if they die, if their avatar dies, then they die in real life. So it's a possibly controversial topic, these VR immersion type video games. So we'll see where that goes, you know, as the technology, you know, keeps moving forward. But hey, we did it, guys. If you stuck with me all the way through here to the end, thank you so much. I wish I could give you like a trophy or something like that, for your effort, to reward you for your efforts, because you're a real trooper. You know, this was a long episode. This was a lot of talking, a lot of talking by me. So thank you so very much for sticking all the way through, if you have. And if you didn't, that's okay. No hard feelings. But that's going to be our show for tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Please don't tune in to our morning show with Heath, you son of a bitch. And check out our other social media content at Mangami Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Thanks again so much for stopping by for a nightcap. Well, I guess in this particular case, it was like a lot of nightcap. a lot of nightcaps. But thank you so much for stopping by. Have a great night. Good night.